Last week, China rolled out the red carpet for US President Donald Trump. This week, if anything, it was even redder carpet for Russian President Vladimir Putin. The US this week also indicted Cuban dictator Raul Castro. You know, just a few months ago, American soldiers flew into Venezuela to arrest Nicolas Maduro. Is indicting Castro a prelude to going in and grabbing him in the same fashion? Latvia is also wondering if they're next, not the next victim of an American decapitation strike, but the next victim of a Russian invasion as Russia embarks on some pretty serious nuclear saber rattling. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Donald Trump wanted Xi Jinping to help us out with Russia, he said. Instead, just a few days after he left China, President Xi had a very warm welcome for Vladimir Putin. To tell us more about this and what it means, we'll start with our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. Vladimir Putin arrived in China on Tuesday for a two-day state visit with a great deal of pomp and pageantry, as you said. This was actually Putin's 25th trip to China since he became Russia's president back in the year 2000. So just a remarkable number of visits that he has made there. And during this trip, Putin held meetings with Chinese Secretary General Xi Jinping and other Chinese Communist Party officials, just all kinds of meetings that were designed to basically strengthen the Russia-China partnership across all levels. During this trip, Putin described Xi as his dear friend. That's the kind of rhetoric that we've increasingly heard these two dictators use with each other in recent years. And during the trip, both Putin and Xi said that Russia-China ties are now at their strongest levels ever. Now, it is true that one of Putin's main goals of this trip was to finally get a deal finalized with China for the Power of Siberia 2 gas pipeline. Russia and China have been trying to get this agreement cemented for several years now, just to pump huge quantities of Russian gas into China through this pipeline. But it seems that Xi Jinping was still not willing to come up to Putin's minimum offer. Xi wants to pay less than Putin is willing to take, and he apparently feels that he has other options. So the Power of Siberia 2 remains offline, and getting it going still looks quite elusive. But Putin and Xi did clinch more than 20 other smaller deals to expand energy, technology, and strategic ties. A whole raft of agreements meant to move the bear and the dragon closer together and just to cooperate more deeply across a wide range of areas. And this deepening cooperation between Russia and China, it is something that the trumpet carefully watches because it is advancing specific biblical prophecies. We have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, and it takes a careful look at passages in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Matthew and Revelation and others. And these passages together show that Russia and China will soon be fully and completely allied together, along with several other Asian nations. And they will merge all of their military forces into an army bigger than any the world has ever seen, bigger by orders of magnitude. And these passages show that this Asian bloc will end up playing a central role in a nuclear World War III. So when we see China hosting Vladimir Putin, rolling out the reddest of red carpets, and this is the 25th time, as I mentioned, and when we see them hammering out numerous agreements and finding all kinds of ways to work more closely together and just to deepen their partnership, that really shows us that the Russia-China axis is essentially here. It is now on the scene. It has arrived. And that booklet that I mentioned goes through all of those various pages, those various passages, and it holds up current events alongside them. So that could be a very powerful read, I think, for anyone who would like to understand these developments in that context. And once again, that booklet is called Russia and China in Prophecy.
So did they agree, Were any of these agreements of any significance, or was it more about the symbolic importance of these two leaders once again meeting after having so many of these meetings and just kind of standing side by side there, and particularly doing so right after Donald Trump had visited?
I think it's a little of each. The agreements themselves are not at all insignificant. It is, we haven't seen concrete details released, but it does show just a general move toward deeper strategic ties, deeper technology ties, deeper energy, cooperation as well. But the symbolism is also enormous here, because as you said, this comes directly on the heels of President Trump's visit. And it shows that as much as President Trump would like to sort of brand his visit to China as something somewhat unique and special, that's not the case. And, if anything, the visit with Putin is even more kind of grandiose, with more of the ceremonial pomp and all of that sort of thing. So the symbolism is huge, just to broadcast to Trump and the whole world that even if Xi does meet with Trump, it doesn't mean anything regarding the Russia-China partnership.
Well, thank you for that. Any other stories from Asia that we should know about this week?
Yes. First up, Russia tested its new Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile on Tuesday. Russian President Vladimir Putin said this is the most powerful missile in the world, and he said that it has a far longer range than its Western counterparts. He also said the Sarmat can, quote, penetrate all existing and future anti-missile defense systems. His claim there about future systems is obviously some bloviating and chest thumping, since he can't know what technologies will be developed in the future. And even now, there are actually some anti-missile systems that hang some question marks around his statement. But the fact is, the Sarmat has shown itself to be a remarkable weapon with just stunning powers of destruction. It has a global reach and can carry 11 tons of payload, including nuclear warheads. So the Sarmat is just powerful proof that Russia's desire to push against the world and to become a military superpower once again is stronger than ever. And then I wanted to end by discussing a trade truce that seems to be materializing between China and the U.S. As we said, it was just last week when President Trump traveled to China. And this week, we started to see the two sides announce some major deals that were made during that trip to reduce tariffs and to boost bilateral commerce between the world's two largest economies. So China said that it had agreed to buy 200 American-made Boeing aircraft, as well as many other aircraft engines and components. And then it also agreed to buy at least $17 billion worth of American agricultural products each year. So these seem like notable and positive developments, but there are many questions about whether this may have come at the expense of America's security commitments to Taiwan. Taiwan is, of course, an independent nation. It's an upstanding democracy of 23 million people and a close partner to the United States. But China calls it a rogue province and has vowed to use force if necessary in order to assert Chinese Communist Party control over Taiwan. And it is worrying that at the same time that these breakthroughs were announced, breakthroughs in trade between the U.S. and China, President Trump said that he might not follow through with a big arms sale to Taiwan. So that would be potentially devastating to Taiwan's ability to defend itself. And analysts are wondering if that's the price Trump paid in order to get these trade concessions from China. So we don't yet know for sure what happened behind the scenes, and we can still hope that Taiwan has not been abandoned, but that may be the way it happened, and we'll be sure to keep you updated on that as the details become clear.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We'll segue over to another island sitting just off the coast of a major power, is very significant for the shipping of that major power, and is also menaced by that major power. We're not talking about Taiwan. We're shifting over to talk about Cuba to get the latest of what is going on there. We'll hear from Andrew Miller.
That's absolutely right. Cuba is an enormously significant island to the United States, always has been since the country's foundation. You can find records going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson about how important it is for America to have influence over Cuba. You just look at a map, you've got this island about 90 miles off the coast of Florida, maybe slightly further than that. From the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. But you've got those two straits on either side of Cuba, and almost half of all America's seaborne trade, I think it's actually 40% of America's seaborne trade, goes right by Cuba into the Gulf of Mexico. So this is definitely an island you can't afford to ignore, and the Trump administration definitely is not ignoring it. There's actually quite a few geopolitical tremors, I'd call them, this week, showing that Cuba may become an even bigger focus in the weeks ahead. One of them is the U.S. military just ordered an aircraft carrier to Cuba. That's one of the way we knew that tensions were rising in Iran, as they rerouted an aircraft carrier from the South China Sea towards Iran. The USS Nimitz was doing military exercises off the coast of Brazil with the Brazilian Navy. It's been reordered to Cuba, so that's a significant data point. The US Supreme Court just ruled in an almost unanimous decision, not quite unanimous, 8-1, that American property in Cuba that was confiscated by Fidel Castro after the 1959 revolution is now legally and officially stolen property. Particularly, that was a court case about the Obama administration using docks owned by American companies that the Castro administration nationalized, and saying that actually that that company is entitled to sue for the use of those docks because the revolution was not legitimate. It had no right to steal that property. Therefore, the property's still American. And then maybe the biggest of these three tremors is that Raul Castro, Fidel's younger brother, is now officially been indicted for murder. Now he's outside of U.S. jurisdiction. He's in Cuba, so he hasn't been arrested yet. But he was the Cuban defense minister in 1966 and personally ordered four U.S. planes helping Cuban refugees make it to the United States, ordered those planes shot down. They were shot down, the pilots flying them, all American citizens died. This indictment is basically, it's not treating this like a war crime. It's treating it as like a civil murder. Like you actually murdered American citizens and now we want to prosecute you under American law. Really interesting to see where this is going, because that's basically the approach that Donald Trump took with Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. He didn't declare war on Venezuela or launch an official military invasion of Venezuela. He charged Maduro with breaking drug trafficking laws in the United States. He's like, you broke U.S. laws trafficking drugs into the United States. So he sent a military force to arrest him and then basically try him in a civilian court in New York for drug trafficking. So this indictment of Raul Castro really opens the door for something similar, to where he's now been officially indicted under U.S. law for killing U.S. citizens. And even this Supreme Court case opens the door for similar things, saying that, like, well, you stole property that was legitimately owned by U.S. companies. And so now you've got at least the opportunity to indict many Cuban officials for broken U.S. law. And I think all of these together, the Supreme Court case about the stolen property, the Raul Castro indictment for murder, the fact that the USS Nimitz is on its way to Cuba, shows the fact that the Trump administration is definitely planning something.
So is Raul Castro guilty or Cuba? Did they, like, how much of this is a kind of a pretext, or how much of this is Donald Trump kind of finally trying to settle a decades-long injustice?
Well, I do definitely think the timing's significant. Like, you did this 30 years ago, and we've never done anything till now. So I feel like the fact that you're doing it now is kind of like a pretext to do something. Now, I feel like legally the big debate over here is, like, whether the planes were in international waters or were in American waters, or were in Cuban waters. There's a little bit of debate as exactly where the planes were when they're shot down. Cuba's claiming that these American citizens violated Cuban airspace, and ergo whatever happened to them after that was like self-defense. America's claiming that they were not violating Cuban airspace. They were in international waters. Therefore, Raul Castro shot down American pilots in international territory.
And I guess if they were in American waters, there could be a case for accidental death or something like that. But definitely a much simpler case in that circumstance. So what is the prophetic implication of all of this, the wider implication of what happens with Cuba?
Well, yeah, this is something we've been watching for a while. And a point I've made before, actually, there's a congressional representative in Florida who is come out very vocal saying that Raul Castro murdered these people. He's also calling this Cuba's Berlin Wall moment, and that, like, you know, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Soviet Union, East Germany turning away from communism. He's saying this is the moment where, like, Cuba's going to be turning away from communism and integrated into the Western world. So some pretty positive things. Now, I really kind of latched on to that phrase and a couple of the articles I've done for thetrumpet.com, just because the late Herbert W. Armstrong, that was, like, one of his most dramatic prophecies that would fulfilled, is that because the Bible prophesies a resurrected Holy Roman Empire where five of the nations are in Eastern Europe and five of the nations are in Western Europe, the 10 toes of the Daniel 2 image are on two separate feet, he said that the Berlin Wall has to come down so that these powers can reunite into a resurrected Holy Roman Empire. And that was filled in dramatic fashion in 1989. And I feel like Mr. Gerald Flurry, it's not as a central a prophecy as the reuniting of Eastern and Western Europe was, but he's made a similar case for Cuba in the fact that there are Bible prophecies in Deuteronomy 28 and Isaiah 23 and elsewhere about this revived Holy Roman Empire Mr. Armstrong talked about economically besieging the United States. And so it comes down to, how do you economically besiege a continent? It's a little more complicated than economically besieging a city where you can just have a big army go around it. Like, to economically besiege a continent, you need control over the oceans, you need control over the sea gates. And in America's case, as we pointed out at the beginning of this segment, since 40% of America's seaborne trade goes through either the Yucatan Channel or the Straits of Florida by Cuba, that's just an extremely important sea gate for us. In terms of, like, if you kind of connect Cuba and the Panama Canal, both important trade routes secured by Theodore Roosevelt at the beginning of the 1900s, I think you can make a strong argument that this, like, Caribbean sea gates are actually probably our most important. And so based on that, just logistically, I feel like it would be very hard for a Holy Roman Empire to, like, properly economically besiege the United States if it didn't control Cuba. It'd be an order of magnitude harder to economically besiege the United States if you don't control Cuba. And so now this analogy of this being Cuba's Berlin Wall moment, it kind of, it's like a two-edged sword here. It's like, yes, like the collapse of the Berlin Wall, this was a good thing for the world. Cuba turning against communism would be great, same as Soviet Union turning against communism would be great. However, these, great in the short term at least, but just like the fall of the Berlin Wall brought Eastern Europe into the German-led Holy Roman Empire with the new EU Mercosur trade deals and stuff like that, the Holy Roman Empire, European Union moving into Latin America. I feel like this Berlin Wall moment may actually end up being Cuba kind of turning away from communism and Russia and China and drawing much closer to Germany and the European Union and the Catholic Church, and laying the groundwork for this time when the Holy Roman Empire economically besieges the United States because it's in close alliance with the Latin American countries that control all these trade routes on our southern border.
Well, thank you for that. Andrew, any other stories from the Anglo-American region we need to know about?
Yeah, I'll do three other quick stories while we're on the topic of trade routes. We just opened up a new, bigger, more secure, more improved U.S. consulate in Nuuk, Greenland. The previous consulate was basically like a red house on a fishing harbor where you could just walk up and knock on the door and come in and say hi. The new one's 32,000 square feet, 3,200 square feet, three stories high, armored plated glass. Room for armored vehicles, the type of consulate that if things turned messy in Greenland, people could flee to and actually be safe inside. The Greenlanders weren't too happy with it. President Trump has been very vocal in the past about his need for, or his want for Greenland to be... basically a U.S. protectorate, a U.S. territory, maybe even a U.S. state, things that Greenland seems to oppose and Denmark definitely fervently opposes. So there were some pretty big protests yesterday at the opening of this consulate. But I feel like this story also highlights the previous story about Denmark being a member of the European Union and this rising tensions between the United States and the European Union, especially over trade routes. Just like the European Union is moving to take control of Cuba, fighting with the United States for control of Cuba, there's also rising tensions between the United States and the European Union over Greenland. Another story here, we had America's big Rededicate to God rally this Sunday. This is an initiative by the Trump administration to rededicate America to God after on its 250th year anniversary. Our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Flory, did his trumpet brief on this topic this week, primarily on just how underwhelming it was. The National Mall fits a million people, and like 15,000 showed up, so it was like less than 2% full. President Trump didn't come, he went golfing. Really no big names from his administration came. The religious people that did come, there's like they had mostly like Christian rock music, some big visuals on the screen of like the founding fathers and a cross merging, not much substance. Franklin Graham was the one guy there who actually stood up and like called out homosexual marriage and transgenderism and a bunch of sins in America that America needs to repent of. And so I feel like his speech was maybe the one highlight of this, of that, like, if we're going to rededicate America to God, means America repenting and turning back to God. So I don't have too much to criticize with his speech, but I feel like he was the only one that made that point. Everyone else, Paula White and the rest, were talking about how God's getting ready to bless America and this is a turning point and things are getting better and better, and pretty much ignored the fact that things are not set to get better and better in America without repentance. And so, again, aside from just a couple comments from Franklin Graham, I feel like the entire thing was not only full of empty seats and underwhelming, but actually didn't even have a Bible-based message.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. Russia isn't merely threatening one specific country, but they've been very threatening generally this week. We've grown accustomed to nuclear war and stories relating to nuclear war, nuclear weapons, dominating our headlines. But it's worth looking at this sobering world in which we live. So over the last week, Russia and Belarus practiced deploying tactical nuclear weapons. This came shortly after Ukraine launched its largest ever drone strike on Moscow. You know, this is one of these long pre-planned drills that's very deliberately there to send a not pre-planned message. You know, it's a threat to Ukraine. You keep this up, you draw blood as you strike, as well as we pummel you, really, as Russia pummels Ukraine. If Ukraine fights back too hard, Russia's trying to show, well, we've got nuclear weapons on the table. We're not saying we will use them. We're not saying we won't. These are tactical nuclear weapons. That's the important difference. A tactical nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon designed to win the battle. A strategic nuclear weapon is a weapon designed to win the war. A tactical nuclear weapon is something that is much smaller. It's something that a power might be tempted to use on the battlefield, you know, something that wouldn't have catastrophic civilian casualties if used as designed, but instead could have, well, huge battlefield casualties, could kill large numbers of soldiers. But these are weapons that seem like they're much more usable. In some cases, they're not massively bigger than conventional weapons. And certainly, you can kill a lot of people in just a conventional attack. So it's on the one hand a dramatic step, but also a more thinkable one. So Russia is deliberately making, you know, a credible threat, something that they might actually use that would bring the world into a more dangerous age. And just while we're on the topic of nuclear stories, this is straying a little into Mihailo's area with the Middle East as well, but Russia also advanced some of its nuclear work with Iran. You know, President Trump bombed Iran, is talking to Iran to try and stop them from getting a bomb. Meanwhile, Russia has resumed work, or work has resumed at least, at Iran's Bushehr nuclear power plant that, Russia's Rosatom chief confirmed that they're helping there, that there are Russian specialists on site, and that they're moving forwards. You had the New START treaty expire in February, this arms limitation treaty that tried to, limit Russia's nuclear weapons, try to limit the United States' nuclear weapons. In reality, everyone ignored this apart from the United States. It was only a limit on the United States, and the only credible way to restore some kind of limit on Russia's nuclear weapons and to place one on China's is for America to cancel that treaty, to threaten to develop more nuclear weapons, and that's what they're doing. But still, you're seeing a global nuclear buildup. At the same time, Russia was directly and overtly threatening Latvia. They accused Latvia of allowing a Ukrainian drone unit to be deployed into Latvian military bases. So again, Russia is, you know, they're smarting from this attack. You're starting to have Moscow, people living in Russia's capital, affected by Ukrainian strikes. And so they're pointing to Latvia and saying, well, you enabled this. It said Russia said to Latvia that its NATO membership will not protect the accomplices of terror from just retribution. Now, Latvia says, no, we didn't do this. I have no idea who's telling the truth or not in this circumstance. But whether Russia was fabricating it or whether Latvia did cooperate with the Ukrainian attack, it's still making clear that Latvia is a potential Russian target. And this might be a good way to weaken NATO, to test NATO. You know, NATO is a self-defense alliance. You know, this is the core promise of NATO, is the Three Musketeers promise, one for all and all for one. You attack one NATO member, you attack them all. But that Article 5 of the NATO Treaty or the North Atlantic Treaty, it doesn't protect a NATO state if they go out and attack somebody else. You know, you can't just start a war as a NATO member and say, right, okay, the rest of the alliance, you've got to rally around me. It's there to defend you if someone else attacks you, but it's not meant to be there so that you could bring anyone else with you. Well, here you have a way for Russia to go to war with Latvia, to attack Latvia, and give NATO plausible deniability to not get involved. Because if Russia strikes Latvia and says, well, we're doing it in response to Latvia, an act of war from Latvia, Latvia using bases or Latvia allowing Ukraine to use bases to attack us, you know, whether or not that is true, you now have a potential reason, a very easy reason for the United States primarily as the biggest military power within NATO to back out. And they could say, well, you know, Latvia engaged in a hostile act against Russia. We believe Russia. They send Latvia helps Ukraine in this attack. Therefore, they're not covered by the NATO protection. Again, that's not to say that this accusation is true, but it gives the United States. Now, it's what Putin is excellent at doing, where it would be another step, a very major step in weakening NATO. You know, this would, okay, maybe that would, it on the one hand, this would be easier for America to sit out than if Russia just attacked somewhere completely out of the blue with no justification. But on the other, it would still then make everybody in NATO sit around and think, well, maybe if I'm attacked, the United States won't be there for me. Are they going to find some small print under those circumstances? And it would, I think, still be the end of, well, I mean, there's so much about the NATO alliance that's ended already, but it would be the end of Europe looking to the United States for protection. Now, of course, this weakening of the NATO alliance, this is Germany's big justification for rearming and remilitarizing. And we have so many headlines about that. You get more and more of these every week. You know, things that would be the top story for Trumpet World 5-6 years ago, well, actually, they pale in comparison now to some of the other steps that Germany has taken. And so they're now kind of just one of these quick news items that we hit. One of those this week was more plans from Germany's interior ministry to upgrade its civilian infrastructure for war. So Germany announced plans to spend about $12 billion through to 2029 on civilian defense infrastructure. They talked about using these funds for building more hospitals and special vehicles, having an alert network. They were talking about a new app. Defense Minister Boris Pistorius, he said, we cannot talk about defense capabilities and invest in them without also giving civil defense the support it needs. Germany's getting its population ready for war. They're also overhauling the promotion system or making some changes there to make it more merit-based, so that you can have your best soldiers rise quickly to the top rather than just time served being what is really the overwhelming factor in promotion. We're seeing Germany thinking about buying long-range weapons from Turkey. They're also thinking about loaning Turkey some American Patriot missiles. So you're seeing Germany work on and making its own defense alliances in the Middle East. We've also seen this with Syria this week, where the European Union lifted sanctions on Syria's defense and interior ministry and three of its intelligence agencies. This comes shortly after it resumed formal trade ties with Syria. The European Council said that reopening trade was a clear political signal of the EU's commitment to re-engage with Syria and support its economic recovery. Mr. Flurry wrote a couple of years ago now, Bible prophecy indicates that through Syria, Germany is about to get control of the Middle East. I mean, these alliances that they're cementing with Turkey, with Syria, this is crucial to watch. So America is stepping back. Germany is forced in many ways to defend itself. All of Europe is forced to defend itself. But there's a lot in Germany that are very pleased with this too, that they've been wanting to be forced in this direction for quite a long time. And it means that Germany can become Europe's largest conventional military, can rearm in this way while being cheered on by the rest of the country, by the rest of the European Union. And Latvia and Lithuania and all of these other countries, especially exposed to Russia, are looking to Germany for leadership, for protection. And they are rising to dominate this new military European power. I mean, this, we've had a lot from Herbert W. Armstrong and from Mr. Flurry talking about how fear of Russia would prompt Germany to unite. I'll play just a clip from Mr. Armstrong on that now.
Now, one of the great things that is urging Europe on, and perhaps the greatest thing that will cause them to hurry and get together on this, is their fear of what's going on in the Kremlin and the Soviet Union. And Andropov is frightening them, and that is going to rush them. They are losing confidence in the United States as having a military umbrella over them to protect them. And they want their own military force to protect themselves. That's the way they feel over there. Now, that is a chief incentive to unite them, and that is taking place.
So keep watching that fear in Europe and the response there. I mean, just more dramatic, fulfilled prophecy. Well, that is about it from Europe. We'll turn now to the Middle East and Mihailo Zekig, where our big story there revolves around yet more political turmoil in Israel, this time prompted by an attack from a European institution that exposes some pretty disturbing views about Israel coming from Europe.
Yes, on Tuesday, Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich announced that he had information the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We filmed a Trumpet World episode on location there, if people would be interested in watching that. But they are investigating him and trying to apply for a secret arrest warrant to send him to The Hague on charges of crimes against humanity or something similar like that. And this apparently is from the behest of the Palestinian Authority, or as the court recognizes it, the State of Palestine, which is a member state of the court. Israel is not, but as a member state, the Palestinian Authority can ask the court to apply for arrest warrants, even for countries not affiliated with it. The day before that, Israel's Channel 12 News reported that it's not just Smotrich, it's also Defense Minister Israel Katz, National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, the Israeli Defense Forces Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir, and his predecessor in that office, Herzi Halevi, may also have secret arrest warrants applied against them. Now, of course, as people that are familiar with this program would know, in 2024, the Corps officially applied for warrants for their boss, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and his original defense minister, Yoav Gallant. And because of that, neither of those men can travel to any countries that are party to the court. If they do, those countries are obligated to arrest them and ship them over to The Hague. But that was all for allegations of starving Gaza, using starvation as a weapon of war in the war against Hamas. And we've written before about how those charges are ludicrous. But if you look at people like Smotrich, okay, technically every government department obviously has something to do with the war in Gaza, but the finance ministry, they fund the military, but every country funds their military through their finance ministry. That's not really that unique, and you can't really say those funds are earmarked for anything in particular of the charges laid on the previous men. So it looks like the reason they're going after Smotrich and some of these other men are more of what they're doing in the West Bank, more of what they're doing in the area the Palestinian Authority is nominally in control of. As far as Smotrich is concerned, as finance minister, he's in charge of funding Israeli settlements in the West Bank, and he's a settler himself, and That's one of the reasons he got the job, was because he wanted that position for that purpose. And also, it controls the funds that Israel sends to the Palestinian Authority for so they could pay their electricity bills. And if this is the case, well, you're seeing the ICC basically say it's not just the war in Gaza, it's not even these controversial elements in the war in Gaza that we're after. We're against any prominent Israeli that has any say whatsoever in the Palestinian territories, Gaza or the West Bank, even if those wouldn't normally be considered crimes against humanity. And by that rationale, I mean, basically every government department in Israel has something to do with the West Bank, because the West Bank borders Israel, because there's lots of Israelis that live in the West Bank, because the actual boundaries of territory are unclear. You could basically indict the whole Israeli government as a bunch of war criminals then, if you wanted. And it looks like that's the direction the ICC is moving.
Yeah, I think this is a really dangerous trend. I mean, it's dangerous for Israel, the way that the world goes after them. I think it's dangerous for the world. Like, this idea that, okay, we'll put rules on war. We'll put laws on war. We'll make certain things illegal, even in war. This approach that says, well, you know, we're not going to outlawing war, or that's too utopian. We're not going to be able to, as human beings, change human nature and eliminate all war. But let's try and put some guardrails on it and set up some things that are beyond the pale. Well, great. But then if you now, like what the court is doing now in their kind of unhinged efforts to go out of Israel, is they're making it almost impossible to go to war without committing war crimes. Like, I'm not sure that it's possible to do that. So then you've got countries like, well, you know, we're going to get prosecuted for war crimes, or we're going to be accused of war crimes no matter what we do. It discredits this whole idea of there being laws in war. I mean, we want people to adhere to basic standards, to not mistreat prisoners, to limit civilian casualties, to not inflict genocide. But it's been twisted now to the point that things that the Allied armies routinely did during World War II, for good reason, in a righteous cause, are now categorized as war crimes. So, you know, then where are your restrictions against war crimes if this view of history now has the Axis and the Allies as equally war criminal? Like, it is undoing this, and it's dangerous for the planet.
Well, that's the thing. It's not even, as I mentioned, not even really about the war itself. If it's the Palestinian Authority going after Smodrich, like, at this point, it's a civil dispute in disputed territories that isn't actually a war. I mentioned Itamar Ben-Gvir. He's not in charge of anything to do with the military. He's in charge of policing. He's not actually in charge of anything going on in Gaza in the ceasefire whatsoever. But he is in charge of going after terrorists that shoot at IDF positions in the West Bank. So at this point, and everybody in the international community is wanting something like this for a while. They've been thinking about this for a while, but they haven't had the rationale to do so. They haven't been as bold as to try something like this. But they're basically saying, again, anything Israel does in the West Bank, even in those territories that per the Oslo Accords are disputed, and that Israel is allowed to have settlements in and could be negotiated on, anything that Israel does there is illegal. Anytime anybody steps on a blade of grass there, it is a criminal offense, and they're liable to be charged in the same level as the Nazis were charged, which, as we've talked about in this program before, no other country in the world is held to this kind of standard. I mean, you think about, you were talking about Russia a little bit earlier. Okay, Putin has a similar warrant over his head. His main person in charge of kidnapping children from Ukraine also has that. But there's a lot of other people in Russia doing very evil things that are not being indicted for war crimes. There's a lot of people in China and North Korea and all these other dictatorships, these lower level men that are doing genuinely evil stuff that nobody's putting an investigation in, nobody's trying to indict. It is only Israel, the only functioning democracy in the Middle East, that gets this treatment.
So what can we learn from this more broadly?
Well, as you mentioned there, these guardrails, institutions like the ICC and other world courts, they're put in there to make war safer, even if we can't abolish war, because that's asking too much. That's asking to change human nature. But the problems we're seeing in these courts, they're fundamentally regressing because of the same issue, because you can't change human nature. War is a problem because of human nature, and because human nature is fundamentally selfish and human nature wants to get. And regardless of whether you're giving that human a gun to cross somebody's borders, or you're giving him a suit and a bunch of legal paperwork to go after somebody else they don't like, that is stemming from the same human nature. Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Fleury, for decades they discussed that this world's problems are caused because no matter what solution man tries to implement to fix war, to fix world hunger or the population explosion or any of these other problems, it's all a human solution devised by the same nature that very often inspires these problems in the first place. And if we're going to solve these problems, then there's going to have to be something fundamentally changed in humanity, not just in one or two enlightened people at the top that you could trust to run the show, but in every person in the world. And when the original indictment for Prime Minister Netanyahu came out, you wrote an article in our print edition called "The Failure and Ultimate Victory of International Law" that goes into a little bit more of those details, and it explains in more detail why, what the problem is and what the solution is, and that it's a sure solution.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. I want to come back to some of those thoughts. Those are some great, profound takeaways from that. But before we do, what else did you have for us from the Middle East?
Well, as usual, there is a lot going on there. Axios reported yesterday a, quote, difficult conversation between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Donald Trump about the Iran war and the negotiations to end the war and how the war will be officially concluded. This talk apparently happened on Tuesday, and one source speaking with Axios said, quote, Bibi's hair was on fire after the call, end quote, after the prospects of President Trump trying to get a deal through, trying to avoid the military escalation, resuming the bombing campaign as much as possible. Which, okay, it's Axios. They have a reputation of having these exclusive stories from anonymous sources that can't be confirmed anywhere else, and we have to rely on this one reporter, or trusting this one reporter that everything's accurate. But if this is the case, then we are seeing more fissures between Israel and the United States on what this war's actual aim is and what they want the world to look like once it's finished. We've spoken before about how this war is exposing divisions between America and Israel, and that Israel will eventually look for other partners to help its security. Whatever happens with this peace, these peace negotiations could very well play into that. Another story regarding the Iran war, this time involving Pakistan. Reuters reported on May 18th that Pakistan, during the war's active fighting, sent 8,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. A squadron of about 16 fighter jets and a Chinese-made air defense system, and even wanted to send warships, although it's unclear if those warships ever made it. Pakistan and Saudi Arabia signed a mutual defense clause. Like NATO, an attack on one is attack against all. Last year, the details of that deal are unknown. This is apparently part of this deal. One source who said they saw the deal themselves claimed that the agreement allows for up to 80,000 troops from Pakistan to enter Saudi Arabia. It's interesting because to this point, Pakistan was one of the main mediators between the United States and Iran, but in this case, it looks like they were fully prepared to go to war against Iran. And one last story, there is an outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo, specifically in its eastern provinces. This is the 17th since 1976, well over 100 deaths by this point. What I think is interesting is that if you look at a lot of the mainstream media, the big figure to blame in this outbreak is United States President Donald Trump. Because he killed U.S. aid, the U.S. is not on top of its disaster response around the world as it could be, and because of that, people are dying in Africa. Okay, maybe if U.S. aid was still functioning, maybe the U.S. would be doing some different things than it is now, as well as a lot of other very bad things that our sister program, the Trumpet Daily, has discussed at length. But, I mean, really, Ebola is Trump's fault now? As I mentioned, it's the 17th outbreak they've had since the 1970s. The last one was last year. This is unfortunately a common occurrence for the Congo, and now all of a sudden President Trump's the villain in all this. I think this is a unique look at just how alive and well Trump derangement syndrome is among so many in power, even if they're not as bold as what they used to be.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. I just wanted to pick up on some of those broader themes that you were saying earlier about mankind's failed attempt to bring about world peace. We've tried through things like the United Nations. We've tried through international law. And now we live in an age where nuclear weapons are sadly common and tested. And I wanted to conclude the show with a clip that really ties together just about all of our segments today into one. Herb W. Armstrong also made a number of significant visits to China. He met with the Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping on at least a couple of occasions. And I wanted to play the message that he brought. This is a recording from Peking's Great Hall, or I guess it would be Beijing now. And you know, he was there telling a lot of China's top leaders about the true way to peace, about the real problems, mankind's inability to solve his problems. I mean, this is really what we focused on a lot on this show. Nuclear war, mankind can't solve. The Middle East, mankind can't solve. International law isn't going to solve this. Donald Trump's visit to China didn't bring peace between the United States and China. What is the solution? Well, that's exactly what Mr. Armstrong spoke to the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party about.
Modern science claimed here some quite a while ago that we could throw away the crutch of superstition and religion now, that science was going to be the new messiah that would save the world. But the principal things that science have contributed, the one perhaps is nuclear power and the weapons of mass destruction that now can erase all human life from off this earth. It is said now that the weapons are in existence, and at least two nations possess them, and many others. I think this nation here possesses that type of weaponry that could erase human life 50 times over, and once would certainly be quite enough. But many leading scientists in the world have been pointing out that there is only one solution. The greatest world problem right now is the question of survival, human survival. Will human life be living by the beginning of the 21st century? And they say that if we don't explode human life and blast it off the earth by the weapons of mass destruction, that the population explosion will do it. Many leading scientists say the only hope is a single one world nation ruling all of the nations of the earth. Only one military establishment and no other military power that could attack it. And yet they say that that's utterly impossible, and in the hands of man it is. But some time ago, the editor of a weekly news magazine in the United States, in an editorial, was saying that it would seem now that the only hope of human survival in this world is the sudden intervention of a powerful, unseen hand from someplace. And I'm here to announce that that is going to happen. That's precisely what is going to happen. And in our time, and peace is coming to all nations and to the whole world.
So world peace is coming, but it's coming by the supernatural intervention of Jesus Christ. And Mr. Armstrong brought that message to the whole world. And what we've tried to show in these Week in Review shows is how all of these different headlines tie right into that spectacular event. And if you want to know more about what the work God did through Mr. Armstrong, the message that he gave, we have that book, He Was Right. Just a fantastic, it's a fantastic introduction to what God did through Mr. Armstrong, but also just a fantastic introduction to watching world events and understanding your world, going through what is significant and what the Bible says about it. We'd be very happy to send that to you. You can get that. You can read that online at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much today for all of our panelists. Thank you to Matthew Threason for engineering and production. We'll be back next week. Until then, keep watching your world.